This is Kanzen Shu, the podcast, episode 515 for the week of November 10th, 2024. What's up, heya, hello, and as a wise Goku said this episode finally, os! Welcome back to Kanzen Shu, the podcast, an extension of the all-encompassing Dragon Ball fan site, Kanzen Shu. We cover anything and everything Dragon Ball in hopes of enlightening and a little bit of entertaining. Need a little bit of that this week. Hey, it's great to be back with you here on the podcast. I've been sitting on this episode for, real time, we're going to go back and look. Let's see. Okay, so I go to the content folder, and then I go to the podcasting folder, and I go to space, and this was recorded on October 6th. Okay, so it's been about a month. We have teased this episode on the podcast, mostly off the podcast, and a little bit on another podcast for a while now. I've been looking forward to it. It's actually one of the most favorite discussions I've had in a while. By the way, hi. My name is Mike. You may see me around as Vegito EX. I am one of the co-founders of this site here at Kanzen Shu. This episode, you know, we've got Daima going on. That's important. We're doing lots of site work with that. We always like to zag when there's zigging going on. So what are we going to talk about instead of the new TV series this week? Hey, we talked about it last time on the show. We are going to talk about space. We're going to talk about real life space and physics and ramifications of things that we see in the series with an expert, my friend and yours. You may know him from Saturday Night Mario Kart, or you may know him from the Space Above Us podcast. JP Burke is joining me to get quizzed on a whole bunch of space questions. Now, who is JP, you may ask, and why is he on a Dragon Ball podcast? What expertise does he bring to the table? He brings no Dragon Ball expertise whatsoever, but as he says himself, he may be a rocket ship pilot? I actually forget how he answered that question, but hey, you're going to learn all about him. He does NASA stuff. That's impressive. That's important. So we're going to talk about everything that you assume we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about space travel and distances and the shapes of the spaceships and aerodynamics and long distance telecommunications. And how does that all work? As I think back on editing the topic, I think my actual favorite little tidbit was what's the ramification of teleportation? What would that actually do? So I just kind of want to get into it. We need this right now. I need this right now. We're going to get over to the topic. I will see you on the flip side to close out some site teases, things we got going on, things to look forward to at Kanzen Shu. And that'll be the podcast episode this time around. Enjoy the conversation with JP. I'll see you on the flip. You probably never thought you'd be on a Dragon Ball podcast.
Yeah, that wasn't really on the list.
Folks who tune in Saturday nights may recognize the voice. JP from
The Space Above Us.
Why are you here?
I'm here because because we're going on a cruise, so I'm here anyway.
So this has been tossed out a couple times. Every once in a while we're playing Mario Kart, someone will be like, hey, what's deal with this space thing in Dragon Ball? How's that work? So I've collected a few questions I want to run by you. Some will have visuals, so I'll provide those to you along the way. But for the most part, we're going to talk some just kind of like theoretical, like what's up with the sun there and distance and how does this get from this place to this place? How realistic is this? So before we get into it, JP, why don't you give us a little background, whatever you can tell us about who you are and what you do in real life.
Yeah, so my name is JP Burke. I have a podcast called The Space Above Us, where I'm covering each and every NASA human spaceflight mission in chronological order. That includes, you know, Mercury, X-15, Gemini, Apollo, Apollo Soyuz Test Project, Skylab, and all 135 space shuttle missions, plus Shuttle Mir. I also work at NASA on, have been working on a mission called OSAM-1. I think that's probably going to be changing soon, probably switching to another mission. But OSAM-1, the goal of that is to go up and rendezvous with a satellite and refuel it on orbit. Pretty rad. I'm helping out with the ground software, basically telling the spacecraft where to go. So if you want to really abstract it away, I can call myself a space pilot.
Nice.
So I know one or two things about space.
Right, great. Well, I have a series of questions. We're really going to focus on kind of like the early part of DBZ, which you do know something about. It's not like you're completely ignorant to what happens in this series.
I've seen Toonami.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's when we take off into space and people go to planets and we have spaceships and that kind of stuff, which you certainly know about. So I kind of have it broken down myself into spaceships, distance, and then some miscellaneous stuff. And then we actually have some submitted questions.
Excellent.
Which I'm excited about. I want to start with spaceships. So the first things that we see for intergalactic travel, I guess you'd say, in the series, are the pods.
Yeah.
We kind of soon/later learn that the pods are for combatants, which is interesting. But I have a couple questions about them. So they're circles.
Spheres, Mike.
All right, sorry. What kind of propulsion, obviously it's a fictional series, could a sphere have?
So you could totally have propulsion with a sphere. One of the most important things, I guess, would be, let me take a step back and say that there actually have been crewed, that is C-R-E-W-E-D, spacecraft that are spherical. The first ever, Yuri Gagarin, flew in Vostok 1, which was a sphere, at least for reentry. A sphere is nice because it's very simple. You obviously, you know, the simplest shape you can really get away with.
Yeah.
You would probably want to have, I'm trying to think, with something like the pod, you probably have just like one or two thrusters along the back, and then you would just slew, you'd rotate where you want to go to control the direction.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, I think with that particular spacecraft, just thinking about the design of it, because if I remember right, they kind of, they load in the front and there's kind of like a seat they sit in.
Yeah.
And then I imagine all the system stuff would be behind them. So that's where I would probably put, you know, maybe one big thruster and then a reaction wheel, like basically a big heavy spinning wheel that you can use to point the spacecraft without having to expend any propellant. So,
got it.
You know, you could totally get away with that.
I mean, one of the side questions there was like, how realistic is this sphere going through space? Seems like, sure.
Yeah, you totally could do it. It's got some disadvantages too. You know, it's going to kind of make it, you know, kind of obviously it's going to be kind of smaller and kind of restrict the geometry you're working with.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to end up with kind of thermal issues because you kind of maximized your volume for the surface area you have available. So now you're going to have to introduce some sort of coolant system to, you know, for whatever system is closest to the center, how are you going to get that heat out of there? But yeah, on broad strokes, you can totally use a spherical spacecraft.
I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but you're also into F1. There's some aerodynamic stuff that comes in there.
Yeah.
Does aerodynamic considerations apply in space?
So more than you might think. So people think about, like, once you're in space, there's no air, but there's actually quite a bit of air. So for instance, I used to work on these Earth observation missions called Terra, Aqua, and Aura, which are in orbit at roughly pretty close to 700 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. And even at that altitude, there is enough tenuous atmosphere left that they have to do a burn every few months or it will slowly pull them out of their orbit. More extreme, the ISS, which is down at more like, oh, what is it, like 400 or 450 kilometers? I'm going to get that wrong, but quite a bit lower. They have this gigantic drag area, you know, the size of a football field with those giant solar arrays. So they'll drop like a kilometer a week from the upper atmosphere. You know, so if they don't get pretty frequent reboosts, it'll just come back on its own and re-enter. But the most extreme is there's a spacecraft called, I don't know how to pronounce it, GOCE. It's an extremely low, very low orbit spacecraft that was measuring basically the lumpiness of the Earth. You know, essentially, okay. You know, the Earth is not a perfect sphere. It's really important to understand that lumpiness in real world spacecraft operations. So this thing was so low, it literally had little wing-like protrusions and would keep an ion engine running in the back to just keep continuously making up for the drag it was losing. So, you know, that's probably the closest. And then obviously, you've got some spacecraft that come back, and you can kind of tell the difference. If you look at like the Apollo lunar module, that thing never sees an atmosphere, which is why it looks like a spider ate a bunch of aluminum foil or something. You know, that operates at the moon and that's it. Whereas the space shuttle, you know, it would land like a glider. So it looks all sleek and nice like an airplane because it basically is.
Right.
And then kind of in between those, you've got something like Apollo. When it would come back from reentry, it was a nice kind of smooth cone without wings, but it could use the fact that the center of mass was offset from the center to sort of rotate from side to side and kind of tweak where they're going to land. So yeah, basically re-entry is important, but even if you're on orbit, you know, you absolutely have to consider air unless you're really, really high up.
Well, let's talk re-entry because the next question here is landing. And I had some questions myself and then this kind of came up in Discord as well. We see a couple things. When Nappa and Vegeta land, they just fucking slam into the city.
Yeah.
And that's it. When Vegeta leaves after that fight and he goes back to one of Frieza's planets, they actually have some like cushioned things that he lands on.
Okay.
So like, no, they're expecting that. But you think about it, they just down.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to think about there. I mean, my reptile brain is like, I don't know, they throw the thrusters backwards at the last second. Like, how do they not get obliterated? What would you do there?
Yeah, so I think the closest analog is the Russian human spacecraft, the Soyuz. It kind of launches in this kind of three-part design with a service module, kind of a reentry module, and then the orbital module. But only the reentry module, as the name implies, comes back. It's kind of this gumdrop shape. And it's super, super stripped down, utilitarian, super small. And they land under a parachute that's kind of not quite big enough for the job. And if they were to land with just a parachute, it would, you know, be kind of like a, you know, it would be pretty bad. It would mess up the crew. So right before landing, they do fire some rockets down very briefly, like literally feet above the ground. And these retro rockets kind of soften the blow to what returning crews have likened to a moderate car crash. but when you watch it, it looks like it blows up because it's coming down all gently. And all of a sudden, there's a flash and a giant burst of dirt everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's like, because those are the retro rockets firing. But, you know, that kind of nerfs the landing enough that they can get away with just having a rough ride and not a catastrophic one.
Gotcha.
As far as, like, you know, Vegeta landing, like, that was a little more extreme, but, you know, they're pretty tough. And presumably they've either invented some really good metal alloys or beaten people up who told them how to make them.
this might make sense for some of the viewers. I don't know. It sounds to me like the space pods go from Super Saiyan God to Super Saiyan Blue at the last second, just to like, and then they're good.
Yeah, I got all that.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So those are those, but there are different ships in the series. I'll jump ahead real quick to Frieza's ship is basically like, I don't want to say like a traditional flying saucer kind of thing, but yeah. It's a saucer. It's got like little appendages here and there where it can land. But I'm going to show you something. This is, I don't know if you remember Kami, Earth's God, who's Piccolo's older green half. He originally came from Planet Namek in a ship that his people made for him. I'm going to show you a picture of this. I assume most listeners will remember what this ship was. But I'm going to show you a picture of it and kind of get your take on, does this ship make sense? Like, how would it fly and what would they do with it?
Let's see what we got here. Yeah, okay, so looking at this, this thing would do atmospheric entry.
Yeah, it's going to leave one planet and come to another planet.
So I think one thing right off the bat that is, you know, I'm no expert in aerodynamics or what do they even call it? Like, you know, hypersonics and all that. But yeah, these protrusions would be real trouble because they're spots where you could start to form shocks. And when you form shocks like that, you can get really, really hot points. You want everything to be nice and smooth and kind of control where the shock waves go.
Yeah.
Just like in a Formula One car, they want to control where the air goes.
Yeah.
Same thing applies even if you're, you know, 50 kilometers up. So that seems kind of troublesome. But also, having these big appendages could be good in space because you could put stuff like your attitude control there and have this nice long leverage arm to, you know, maybe be a little more efficient about it. It's a weird looking spacecraft, though. I'm kind of curious how it lands. Is there like a thruster or something underneath it? It just comes straight down or what?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough in the manga because, I mean, you don't get motion from it. So in the anime, obviously, they add whatever they add. And
sure.
You can take a look at that. So we just kind of get like, they just like it goes super fast, like almost instantaneous. Like it just bursts up into the air and then they're off out in space.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That seems like it'd be rough on the crew.
Right. They got big old chairs in there. So I don't know if they like strap in or something, but
I guess, yeah. One question with that would be, what is the propulsion system? You know, is it, maybe it doesn't need thrusters cause it's doing some sort of crazy quantum manipulate space time nonsense that definitely is real.
All right. Well, I want to talk about, we're basically are talking about Namek off in space. So after the battle with Vegeta and Nappa, Goku's in the hospital and everyone's like, all right, what are we going to do? We got to go wish people back. We're going to go to that planet. They have the Dragon Balls. So they're talking with Kaio.
They're big there.
Yeah, they are bigger Dragon Balls. I'm talking with Kaio, North Kaio, which we later learn, one of the catfish god, because he knows where things are in space. So he's talking, they're talking with Bulma, and they're like, okay, well, how are we going to get there? And so they end up with coordinates, and they say something like, I'm reading this from the Viz manga, but the numbers and letters themselves are there in Japanese. In Earth terms, it's bearing SU-83-9045YX. And then Bulma freaks out with a 9045YX. How do you describe, I guess ignoring that, but also coming back to it for a second, how do you describe, okay, we're here on Earth, there's this thing over here in space.
Yeah.
How do you describe where that is? Because there's no up.
Yeah, so there are actually multiple different systems for doing this, and it's really important to pick the one that's appropriate for whatever problem you're working on. It can make life a lot easier. So you know, these are, you're talking about basically picking both coordinate systems and reference frames. So I guess kind of the, let's start with one that we are both familiar with, like latitude and longitude.
Yeah.
So your coordinate system is kind of just degrees, where we put 0, 0 is on the equator, on the prime meridian, which is like due south of Greenwich in England. And then, you know, one number is what, how, you know, your rotation around the equator, and the other number is how north or south of it you are. Mm-hmm. And your reference frame is Earth fixed reference frame, because it's, your reference frame is rotating with the Earth. So if you're sitting in one place, your coordinates don't change. What you can also do is, you could be in an inertial reference frame, which is basically, kind of imagine it as from the point of view of distant stars that aren't affected by the rotation of the Earth. So in that case, you know, even if you were just sitting, we're just sitting here right now, our coordinates and that reference frame would be constantly changing, because the Earth is rotating around its axis and revolving about the sun.
Right.
But you could also, you could have Earth-centered inertial, you could have sun-centered inertial, you know, you could, if you wanted to get nuts and start talking about between different solar systems, you would have, you maybe use the center of the galaxy as the center of your system. So it's interesting. You said, the manga said bearing. So that indicates to me that they're getting a direction, but maybe not the range, because you really need three numbers. You know, even with latitude and longitude, the kind of implied third number is the radius of the Earth. You're assuming that you're on the surface of the Earth or close enough to it that, like, that's the number. You could totally use kind of a similar thing. So, like, you know, if you're into astronomy, you would have azimuth, which is kind of like you're rotating side to side, and elevation, which is how high up you're pointing. You know, straight up would be 90 degrees, straight ahead would be zero. But then you also need the range, which if you're flying to a distant planet would be pretty important. So either way, you're going to need three numbers.
Interesting. Okay.
So I guess in this case, they're probably using like the center of the galaxy as the center of the reference, or they might still just use the sun and just, you know, bring it way out. But this would be a real headache for anyone trying to design a mission between these distant planets, you know, to figure out all the relative motion and exactly what coordinate system would be appropriate to use.
You know, it kind of gets me thinking, as I just said, Kaio, we later find out he's the North Kaio. And again, there's no north, south, east, west in space. But then we kind of learn from Toriyama that the entire cosmos is actually this giant, like, sphere itself, where everything is inside, so you can kind of like fudge it a little bit. But yeah, there's not really like cardinal directions in space, I guess.
Yeah, you have to define it. And so, you know,
so he defines it by, I drew this thing and here's where stuff is.
That's literally what we do. So I mean, for instance, when you're talking about like you know, the Earth fixed inertial coordinate system, they literally just decided, like, okay, this, like, this date, this time of year, this line is pointed towards this constellation, and we're just going to use this as our reference. And like, that's just the line you use for everything else throughout the entire year. You got to pick something at some point. You want to pick something that's unchanging. In fact, one of the challenges for like really, really deep space navigation is, you know, what do you use as a reference? And there's been some work on that recently using quasars and pulsars for that. There's a mission called NICER Sextant, which is some kind of horrible tortured acronym, up on the space station that's just looking at these kind of blinking pulsars around the galaxy. And each one has their own distinctive blink pattern. And by just looking at those, you can kind of figure out where you are in the solar system or the galaxy just from that. It's kind of like natural GPS for the whole galaxy. So they might end up using something like that. You know, these are kind of arbitrary points, but they're steady and predictable, and we can use those.
Yeah.
But at some point, you just got to pick, this is zero, and we're going from here.
During these conversations, Bulma says, with her dad's fastest ship, it would take 4,339 years and 3 months. So, yeah, we get into these conversations about, like, okay, with Earth technology and acknowledging Capsule Corporation has some pretty advanced stuff, like, this is not close. Right. But I guess they wouldn't necessarily measure it in, you're going to measure it in light years, are you? What is the measurement of, I want to go to this planet?
I guess it depends on the problem. So I guess if you're talking about distance or time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because light year
is both. Yeah, sure.
Light year is a measure of distance, and then, you know, how long it takes to get there. That's, you know, it, so that literally a light year is how far, how much distance will a beam of light, a photon, cover in one whole year. So it's a little bit misleading, because it sounds like a unit of time.
But I guess that's with this specific technology. So you kind of have a frame of reference of this thing that we have versus, well, then we find out we've got Kami ship, and then we've got another that Goku travels on to.
Another thing to kind of throw into the mix here is, I wonder, if any of these vehicles do what they call continuous thrust. So usually when you think of spacecraft, they do kind of like, if you're going to the moon, you do one big burn for a few minutes around when you're around the Earth. They call it translunar injection, fly out to the moon, do another big burn to drop into orbit. But if you have a certain type of engine, you can just leave it on the whole time. Mm. And usually they're very low thrust, but they're continuous. And so, you know, I think there's a good quote in The Martian, Mark Watney says, you'd be amazed at how fast you can get going by accelerating continuously for a long time. And it's totally true. You know, there are missions that really do this, where they'll just leave the engines on for month after month, slowly building out. Mm. But you can get going crazy fast if you end up basically accelerating towards your target. And halfway you turn around and start decelerating, so you arrive at zero when you get there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think probably, you know, I would wonder if the Capsule Corporation ship was maybe just doing, you know, a couple of big burns and coasting for most of the way.
Yeah.
Whereas something more advanced can do just thrust the whole way there. And, you know, maybe you could pick up, you know, simulate gravity as a benefit of that because you're being
thrown back. We'll talk about gravity in a second.
All right.
Then we get to things where, so with Kami Godship, it ends up taking them 34 days. And then when they retrofit the Saiyan thing that Goku uses, he gets there in 6 days. So like you can see the escalation of Earth to Namekian to Saiyan / Frieza technology there.
And, he gets there in 6 days and it's light years away?
Well, we don't. So the thing with Namek is we don't. Doesn't appear to be in North Kaio's jurisdiction, but he's aware of it. So it's at least in a different cardinal direction quadrant of the cosmos.
I'm just saying, if you're going faster than light, you're pulling some shenanigans there.
Well, we'll talk about faster than light in a second for sure. So I'm going to have some more questions, I think, that might circle back to some of the stuff when we get into the submitted questions. I got some miscellaneous stuff. JP, can you actually push someone into the sun? Two additional questions. Wouldn't they just burn up, and would gravity push them into orbit? Like, what do you have to do to... All right. So Goku in one of the movies pushes Kula, Frieza's brother, with a Kamehameha just straight off Earth into the sun.
Okay.
And then later in GT, he pushes Baby... His name is Baby.
His name is Baby.
Baby. Into the sun. Could you do that? Like, what force is necessary to, like, straight line, into the sun? Not just, like, burned up approaching the sun, but, like, into it.
So, for one thing, it's surprisingly hard to get to the sun because you're revolving around it and you have to get rid of all that energy to actually hit it. So, there's a mission called the Parker Solar Probe that is studying the sun up close. It's got this kind of crazy, you know, heat shield and radiator so it can get, you know, pretty close to it. But it's this tiny little spacecraft that could practically fit in this room that had to launch on the biggest rocket available at the time to even have a chance of doing this because it has to slow down so much to get anywhere near the sun. Now, maybe Goku can just like overpower that and just blast directly at the sun. If you want to drop lower in an orbit, you don't want to kind of thrust in that direction. You want to actually thrust, you know, counter to your velocity. So really, he should, I guess, let me think, what do you want to do? What time of day was it?
It was daytime.
It was daytime.
But what is daytime on one side of the planet versus another?
Yeah, let's say he's on the equator on the equinox at noon.
Okay. I mean, it is the dragon world, so it's not like our actual continents or anything. So it's a fictional world, fictional sun, but still our solar system, more or less.
You're going this way. I can't do this off the top of my head. It'd be east or west. Do east or west. You don't want to throw them that way. But then also you have to wait like a couple months for him to approach the sun as he drops in. So maybe it's more direct. If you got the thrust, you can go anywhere.
I mean, at this point, we are talking about like the physical manifestation of energy
propelling
someone.
How much delta V does Goku have in him?
I don't know how to answer that question. That kind of reminds me of the moon. So we blow up the moon in Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
What would be the effect of that?
That's a bad thing. That's a bad idea. For one thing, I think so. I feel like a few things over the years in fiction have blown up the moon, and I don't think any of them, Dragon Ball included, really considers the pieces of the moon are still there. Like,
sure. Yeah.
There's something still there. So you're going to end up with stuff like the pieces are going to want to kind of clump back together gravitationally and kind of make the moon again, which I think could be, you know, that's could be something they could use in Dragon Ball. But like,
well, the moon does come back. So
does it come back?
Yeah, they do.
Does it like, is it all like lumpy and hot? Cause it's,
I don't think it naturally comes back. It's after a while, like pre-Z. Earth's god is like, yeah, we wanted to have the moon back. So they took Goku's tail off so they wouldn't have to worry about him transforming anymore.
That's a lot easier.
Yeah.
But if you just assume the moon vanished, that would have a lot of for one thing, obviously, the tides would be completely screwed up.
Well, that's the thing, yeah.
Which would be not great. You'd also
consider a Kame house out on an island in the middle of nowhere. It's going to be decimated.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what would happen because, you know, this is like so non-physical that like if you just disappeared in an instant, like would it kind of cause like a reverse tide as everything kind of settles back down or like or would everything just mellow out and you just wouldn't have any tides at all? I mean, that would be the eventual state.
Okay.
Something that I'm sure that no one, you know, reading Dragon Ball cares about is you'd also lose out on a lot of really interesting kind of options for spacecraft. You know, there's a lot of spacecraft that will do what they call like a double lunar flyby, where you kind of like fly by the moon to go out into this really deep orbit, kind of let your orbit be tweaked by the sun and do these tiny little burns and come diving back in to get
back
tweaked around again.
Yeah.
And you can kind of like, by using this trick, you can kind of do some really slick things without using a ton of propellant. You know, so you know, there are a number of missions that have done stuff. I think like Wind and I think Ace did that. So you're ruining these cool missions by blowing up the moon.
And of course, Man Wolf can't transform back into a man.
Right.
Important. we've talked about gravity a couple times. What would be the effect of 10 times gravity on just a regular everyday human?
So not great. However, there are you can get an idea of this of so back to reentry. So when you're reentering from space, you have to go from roughly 17,500 miles an hour if you're in low Earth orbit to zero without dying in between those. So you want to kind of stretch it out a little bit. But the simplest way to do this with the earliest spacecraft is what they call ballistic entry. You're not doing any kind of lifting shenanigans to adjust your landing point or anything or slow yourself down. You're just kind of screaming on in. And that's what Project Mercury would do. So you'd end up with these really short reentries that are really punishing on the pilot. And if you listen to the audio of the Freedom 7 flight, the first ever crewed American space flight with Alan Shepard, you know, it's the whole flight end to end is 15 minutes. So you can listen to the whole thing. He goes up, he's up in space for a few minutes, tests the vehicle, comes back down. This guy is a fighter pilot, super, super fit guy. And you can hear him just like holding on through reentry. He's literally just going, okay. And that's about between 9 and 12 G's, depending on where you are. So it's kind of right in there. Another fun story about that was kind of roughly the same amount of G's is so astronaut Don Pettit happened to be on the space station during the Columbia accident. So he ended up being up there a little bit longer than expected. And instead of coming back on the shuttle, he had to come back in Soyuz. Soyuz is the Russian spacecraft they use for getting to and from the space station. And he also wasn't entirely sure like when there'd be another opportunity to bring cargo back from the station. You know, no one knew when the shuttle was going to be up and running again. So he wanted to bring all of his like film and camera gear back with him. Now, there's not really any room in the Soyuz other than like literally in your lap. Like, so you were just jammed in there.
So kind of like the space pods that Vegeta and Nappa are in. It's like, here's a seat and boop.
Honestly, yeah. It's like not that far off, except you got three guys in there. So it's you're really, really, really jammed in there. So he just brought this bag full of all his photo gear on his lap. And then there was a glitch with the software. And instead of having a nice, you know, lifting body type entry, they had a ballistic entry. And so I think they hit like something between like 10, 12, maybe even 15 G's briefly. And he's got this bag of stuff on him. And he's been in space for like six or seven months. And so it's funny because he got out later.
Obliterated his pelvis?
Well, he kind of looked a little bit rough. And they're like, Don, you all right? And then they found out it's like, you had like, you know, 500 pounds of photo gear in your lap. So, you know, he ended up being, as we speak, he's back on the space station right now, you know, which is impressive because he just had his 69th birthday. So it's just like,
nice.
You know, it's his third stint up there. And he's one of these guys that just like, that's like his native habitat.
That's his thing.
He loves it up there.
Wow. Not really gravity related, maybe a little bit, but constant question is, are they fighting in space? Can they survive in space? It turns out Frieza may be able to survive in space because that's his whole thing. He's going to destroy planet Namek because he understands / knows science cannot survive. So he'll just blow the fucking thing up. And
that'll do it.
He'll go away and that'll be fine. Later. And then there's other stuff like in the Bardock special. You heard of Bardock?
Yeah.
he like flies up to challenge Frieza, but you know, maybe not canonical. But then we get Battle of Gods. And towards the end, Goku is up fighting Beerus in what seems to be outer space, and we literally get clarification that they are in the stratosphere. What's the deal there? Could he breathe? Would he breathe worse?
So if you're in the stratosphere, for one thing, you're not in space. And I'm going to really emphasize that because...
And I think that's the understanding
you see a lot of these balloon projects. We sent a camera to space. No, you didn't. Balloons can't go to space. You sent a camera into the stratosphere, and that's really cool. So just own that. But that's another argument. If a human was suddenly exposed to the stratosphere, it would be a real bad day. It is above what's called the Armstrong limit, which... I should probably know precisely what that is before invoking the term, but more or less you could think of it as this is the highest you can be and humans could be alive at all. What's going to happen is there not going to be any air, but your lungs will basically work backwards. You know, any oxygen in your blood is going to depart it rapidly. So you're going to have only a few seconds of useful consciousness. You know, your body might kind of truck along for a minute or two, but you're going to pass out almost right away. And the atmospheric pressure is so low that you're going to end up with situations like, so Goku would experience what was experienced by a spacesuit technician during a test in a vacuum chamber. When the technician's suit failed, before he passed out, he experienced the saliva on his tongue boiling off because the boiling point changes when the pressure drops. So it wasn't that it was hotter. It's just that the pressure was so much lower. Boiled off. And like, you know, if you aren't immediately, you know, rescued from a situation like that, even like the gases in your blood will boil out. It's not going to be good. So, you know, realistically, you've got a couple seconds of consciousness and then that's it. And, you know, you'll die of something, whether the cold or lack of oxygen or what. But maybe Saiyans are different.
All right. I'm going to read the full quote here. This is from Toriyama. This comes from... So they did a full colorization of the Dragon Ball manga at some point. It kind of coordinated with when Battle of Gods is coming out. So this is from the Full Color Comics Frieza Arc, Volume 5. It's one question talking about battle scenes. Then Toriyama kind of goes into this other tangent and he says, I thought that things would get out of hand if they fought right there at Capsule Corporation, but naturally the location changed. And he laughs. To think that they go all the way into the stratosphere. So this is Toriyama himself saying the stratosphere. But thinking about it, they're both aliens after all. Maybe they can just barely breathe.
No. No, I don't think so. It's also going to be super, super cold. There's a lot of problems. For one thing, do they talk to each other at this altitude?
Yes, they do.
No, absolutely. That's not going to work. There's not enough air for that. And maybe they're really, really loud.
Okay, so let me clarify this even further. So Julian, our translator, he gave an additional translator note for this section. So I got to see if we need to adjust Julian's note here. He says, judging by the film, they're in low Earth orbit, which is in the ionosphere, and definitely not survivable by ordinary mortals, but let's not overthink this. So what do you think, stratosphere versus ionosphere?
I mean, that note is right. So the stratosphere, you're not in orbit. Either that or you have one amazing heat shield and propulsion system.
Well, they just fly up there.
Low Earth orbit, you are in the ionosphere still, which the ionosphere is really important because, you end up with a lot of plasma up there, kind of messes with certain radio signals, which usually isn't that big of a deal, but for something really sensitive like GPS can make a huge difference. But you actually just made a really good point. If they just fly straight up, you can be in space without being in orbit. So if you just fly straight up, let's say 100 miles, and you turn off your thrusters or your flying magic, whatever, you're just going to fall back down. You're just going to fall straight
back
down.
And that is what happens. Goku kind of like loses and then just literally drops back down to Earth.
Perfect. So the difference is if you ever watch a rocket launch, you'll see it go up. But the reason it's going up is only because you can't go... at orbital velocities.
Sideways from Earth, I guess.
You can't go 17,500 miles an hour at sea level and remain a vehicle for very long. So they go up to get above the atmosphere. But if you watch, they will start turning to the point where usually it kind of looks like they're flying back down because they're far over the, they're over the horizon, still flying sideways. Eventually, you're going to go from vertical to sideways by the time you get to orbit because then you can, go around the Earth and you're basically falling and missing the Earth. So if these guys are just going straight up and Goku passes out and falls back down, that's pretty good.
Okay.
Definitely not low Earth orbit, though.
All right. Man, I got some other questions here before we get to some of the submitted questions. Going back to folks who are off on Namek, Bulma sets up this like little portable satellite phone system.
Okay.
And apparently has real-time communication with folks back on Earth.
Okay. That's a neat trick.
Not possible.
No, speed of light. So, again, it depends on how far away. So let me put it this way.
They seem to think it's very far away.
Very far away. So you can kind of get a feel for this. It's not often you really get a feel for the speed of light. But one thing you can do is if you look up footage of like any of the missions, let's say Apollo 11, you know, the moon is roughly 400,000 kilometers away. It's basically, that should be about a second, 1.2 seconds, something like that. Either way, it's a light second away, essentially. Okay. So think about how difficult it would be to use, you know, a voice chat if there's a 1 second delay built in. And you'll hear them kind of talk on top of each other. Yeah, and the ground kind of had to train themselves to, like, the crew's going to get priority. So, like, you know.
God, we have this every fucking day with Zoom calls now.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, but, like, it, even worse. And so, but you can even hear, if you listen for it, on there, on the crew's end, you will kind of hear the tail end of the ground's transmission coming back. Mm. And that's only to the moon, which is not that far away. So, you know, unless they've got some sort of crazy instant faster than light communication, that's not going to work. And also, the first thing I thought of is, okay, you're setting up this like satellite terminal. Did she bring satellites that are in Namek orbit? Like, what is that talking to? Is it just going directly right back to the Earth? Okay, well, are we pointed towards the Earth at this moment? What time of day does that work? You know, there's lots of different questions that, you know, once you start really getting into it, you have to start figuring out, like, okay, well, when are our comm windows open? How do we plan around that? And, oh, here we go. We got a photo of it. Okay, so we got here is a little parabolic dish that I guess is pointing back towards Earth, little high-gain antenna. So, yeah, you could do that, but you'd be waiting, presumably, a few years for them to get the signal and then a few years for it to come back. But, yeah, that's a nice little setup. I wonder, I also don't think it's very powerful enough to, you know, travel those kinds of distances.
Is Capsule Corporation.
Is that a leg of the weird spindly vehicle that she's leaning on?
That's the spaceship. That was Kami's God's spaceship. There you go. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
I think I have one last one before we get to submitted questions. What about time dilation?
Okay. So
shouldn't hundreds of years have passed by the time they come back?
It depends, again, on how fast they're going. So general relativity, which is what we're talking about here, is really, really weird. So it kind of boils down to things can't all happen at the same time due to how information moves. And the thing that's got to give is time. The upshot of that is that the faster you're moving relative to someone else, the slower you experience time relative to them. And it's all relative. There's no absolute frame of reference. There's no stopped. Everything is moving relative to everything else. So if you were to fly out to another solar system at, you know, close to the speed of light, for you, the trip might only take a few weeks, but for someone on Earth, it might take years. It depends on how close to the speed of light you're getting. And just since we're on this, I'll mention a really something that kind of will hurt your head in the way that it, you know, kind of illustrates how mind-bending general relativity is. Let's say you're traveling at 99.999% the speed of light.
Right.
Or we'll make it easier. We'll make it, say, 99% the speed of light, and you're in, you've got headlights on your vehicle for some reason. Mm-hmm. You turn on your headlights in the direction of travel. How fast is that light traveling away from you? You're going 99% the speed of light. You turn on your headlights. How fast is that light going?
The speed of light?
It's going the speed of light relative to you. So
the speed of light plus 99?
So this is where it gets crazy. No matter what, light moves at the speed of light, no matter what your reference frame. Okay, so if you are passing a planet at 99% the speed of light, you turn on your headlights, you will see the light leave you at the speed of light. But the people on the planet who are basically at rest compared to you will also see it leave you at the speed of light. So from their point of view, it'll just kind of creep a little bit ahead because it's only going, you know, 1% faster. But for you, it goes way further out. General relativity is like, I'll put it this way. I took a GR class taught by a friend of mine who's an world-class expert on this stuff. And every once in a while, I just kind of raise my hand. And you're like, yeah, I'm like, I don't like it. That's too bad. So yeah, they should totally have time dilation effects, but since they clearly are throwing all that stuff out the window by instant communication back to Earth, all bets are off.
Yeah, yeah. We have some submitted questions here, some names you might know, some names you might not know.
All right.
Ken, give me a good one here.
All right.
There are two instances where Goku must escape a celestial body's gravity.
Okay.
We have on the way to Namek in filler material, he's like fixing his spaceship and he like Kamehameha's
away. Wait, Goku knows how to fix a spaceship?
Look, there are a lot of questions we have here. And then in some GT stuff as well. I feel like we kind of talked about this earlier with gravity, but what kind of strain would that put on a humanoid body to achieve such a feat?
You want to hit escape velocity around some celestial body?
Yeah.
I guess, what is it?
Yeah, it seems to be a star for Goku in the space filler.
Should be no big deal. I mean, depends on how far away from it he is, but, you know, gravity would not be my concern for escaping a star. You know, at a certain point, that's actually pretty easy. I mean, humans have done this in real life a number of times. We've got the Pioneer 11 and 12 and Voyager 1 and 2 and New Horizons. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I think those might be the only ones. They've all escaped the solar system just by normal chemical rockets and a couple of, you know, nicely timed gravity assists. So that shouldn't be too big of a deal. I think for it to be a big of a deal, you'd have to be around some really extreme objects. You know, obviously, if you're too close to a black hole, you're inside the event horizon, no one's getting out, even light, even Goku can't do it.
Yeah.
But you could have something that maybe is close to a black hole or you're close to the event horizon that could make it a real challenge. But also, those objects are so extreme that I think you're going to have different lethal effects anyway before you're really worrying about that.
We talked about the speed of light just a second ago. This comes from Kevtrev in our Patreon chat on Discord. Some question about the speed of light. Dragon Ball characters can probably move faster than it, and that's debatable over time, despite being physically impossible. So how does a character like himself, let's assume for the sake of argument, that character can move faster than the speed of light. So we do have teleportation in the series. Teleportation is Shunkanido, literally instantaneous movement. Colloquial word is just teleportation. So we have that. Never mind just how fast someone can like run around the planet. We have Gotenks and Arale that can like run around the planet.
I want to say, if you could teleport somewhere and just appear literally instantly, something they don't touch on is the air that was there would have to move. And it had to move so fast, they would compress so quickly that it would
be like an explosion that goes outward.
It'd be like a nuclear explosion because you would literally you'd be shoving it so fast that it would heat up to preposterous levels. I mean, impossible levels.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's very rude to teleport around on Earth.
Kevtrev finishes. I don't even know how to phrase this question, but just like characters moving faster than light, and then considering also while they do travel through space in vehicles, what do you do with that? I don't know what you do with that.
I mean, at that point, you had to make up your own physics for why you can go faster speed of light. But then, I don't know. You tell me. It's like, if you're going to do that, which, you know, it's a story, that's totally fine. Are they at least like self-consistent about what the rules are for, like, you know, for instance, is there some, I guess, so there's probably not some sort of time dilation effect.
Definitely not.
So it sounds like they're probably just ignoring general relativity, you know, that's fine. You know, you don't need to, you know, get into that. But I think that it'll make things a lot easier in a lot of different ways. So I can see why they would ignore that.
I don't know how to say this name now that I think of it. Is it Gelsimel? Gelsimel? Couple questions here, but we kind of go back to the space pods and Vegeta and Nappa, I don't want to say they go into suspended animation, but they kind of just sit there with their arms crossed.
Yeah.
For a year until they get there. What kind of, I don't even know what that question is would be. How would you sustain a person without exercise, getting up, going about doing stuff?
You wouldn't.
Yeah.
So if you tried to do that with a human, so I'll say this, one of the most important things they do in space is work out. So, you know, literally, astronauts spend 2 or 3 hours a day working out. Because
I mean, this is one of the greatest scenes in 2001 is.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, or the much less glamorous version of, you know, the crew of the space station fighting with their treadmill breaking again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's super, super important to work out because, you know, at least with human physiology, you know, use it or lose it. You know, you're going to start losing heart muscle. You're going to lose, you know, your bones aren't getting that much use. So the calcium just kind of goes out. You basically get osteoporosis. All sorts of nasty stuff will happen to you surprisingly quickly, like to the point where even longer shuttle flights, which are only like 2 weeks, they would worry about the commander who actually flies the vehicle. Are they going to like pass out while they are trying to land this thing and trying to, you know, the shuttle reentry is really mild. It's only like 2 G's tops, but like even just being out of the being in weightlessness for 2 weeks can really affect you that way. So sitting like that, just like they must have some sort of hand wavy technology to put them into suspended animation. Otherwise it's not going to work.
So something I think about, we see after that fight, when the folks go off to Namek, we see Kudin and Gohan do what's called image training, where they're just sitting there, but in their minds, they're fighting against each other. And then after they're done fighting, they're like totally out of breath and they collapse from it.
Yeah.
So there seems to be like, well, we're going to use the key element to like, it does technically affect our physical bodies. So maybe Vegeta and Nappa are like image fighting the whole time.
If you die in your brain, you die for real.
Yeah, maybe.
What did they use? What was that thing that Goku was in like a big tube full of water with a cool mask on?
The healing tanks, the rejuvenation chambers.
Use that. So that way, as you're dying from not exercising, it's also healing you at the same time.
Maybe it's just like spritzing some of that into the air
every
once in a while. Yeah, okay. That's...
They're going to come out and be a little bit logy and need a minute before they can start fighting, though. Yeah, yeah. Can they just land and immediately start fighting? Are they good to go?
They do. So they get out and Nappa just fucking blows up the city immediately.
So maybe the vehicle wakes them up a little bit early, like a day or two ahead of time.
Maybe.
To kind of
sure,
like, all
sure.
right, time to wake up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Eat this power bar. This week's episode brought to you by Power Bar, unilaterally by me.
We have a couple questions around here about civilizations and like technology. We have the fact that the Saiyan back history seems to change. Like, are they cavemen and then they like take over the Sufurians and get their technology? And how would cavemen know how to use that technology?
Beat up the nerds.
Yeah, it seems to be exactly what it is.
So no one wants to know about how you write some software to calculate communications windows when you're, when can we see the Tedris network versus the ground network?
Well, we've already established that Bulma can just have instantaneous conversations with Earth.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I guess none of this matters anymore. Oh, I have one here from Bryce.
Oh, no.
Who would win in a fight? John Blaha or Mr. Satan?
Mr. Satan would for sure.
Okay.
John Blaha is a former space shuttle commander and also was one of the seven astronauts to live and work on the Russian space station Mir for a long duration, 4 or 5 months. I forget exactly what it was. And he is, I've met him twice, and he's just kind of like this weird dude. And he's kind of fascinating. If you read interviews by him, he kind of has this shtick that he goes with where he almost pretends to be stupider than he is, because it almost gives him license to keep asking questions over and over so he can make sure he can really understand something.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of, from as he tells it, drives people nuts by preparing for a mission by asking the same questions again and again and again, but then he knows everything. But he's just, I saw him present, he's like, these are what I like to call engineer people. Like, that's what they all, we just call them engineers, my dude. So yeah, my Mr. Satan is like a goober compared to like all the fighters, but he's like
he's a legitimate fighter. Yeah,
yeah, like he can sure. kick our ass.
Yeah, yeah, no problem.
Even if we had the shotgun.
Yeah.
Wait, who wins? Farmer with a shotgun versus Mr. Satan?
Mr. Satan can't move faster than light. So, I mean, the farmer, if he's a good shot, we don't know what kind of shot he is.
Maybe you can intimidate him into missing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't want to have this conversation. What didn't anyone ask that feels like it would be kind of like critical information or just like a fun fact about whether it's space travel or the universe or the cosmos in general?
I want to know about like...
Oh, yeah, let's do this. You ask me questions. Great.
I want to know about like, say, in NASA... Because if they've got all these vehicles flying all over the place.
Sure. Okay, so the deal is that they are just subjugated by Frieza and his entire empire. So it's Frieza who has all the actual technology.
But do they have like... Does Frieza got like a bunch of like mission operation centers somewhere?
He
where he's tracking each like, this group is going here, this
yes.
group's going here.
Yeah, so he actually has a variety of planets out there. One of the most notable ones is Frieza planet number 79.
Good
so
day.
We actually have numbers for what some of the planets are, and there are a variety of literally numbered planets, so we kind of know he's got others out there. And 79 is where Kiwi, I don't know if you remember the purple aliens got Vegeta fights. Vegeta blows him up on Namek. So like there are all these characters at these different bases and they're kind of keeping an eye on things. And 79 is where Vegeta flies and lands on after his battle on Earth. And they're like, oh shit, why isn't Nappa with him? So
yeah.
like they're kind of keeping an eye on
he
what's
stayed
going on.
And ran
out there.
For governor.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's actually really, because like that's the kind of stuff that like nobody knows about, because a lot of it is kind of boring unless you're involved in it. But like I think it'd be really fascinating to learn more about like the spaceflight operations of this stuff. You know, how are they making these vehicles? How are they launching them? How are they tracking where stuff is? How are they planning comm passes? And of course, it'd be ludicrous to include any of this in Dragon Ball,
sure,
but
sure.
that's exactly where my mind goes to.
Well, and we get just enough of that where it's like, oh, we did cut to Frieza Planet number 79 and they're at control systems
yeah.
and they're keeping an eye on
the
things.
Fact that you could just show the room full of people doing this. It's like, okay, we
yeah.
don't know the details, but we know that there's someone's doing something. That's
yeah, yeah.
really cool.
Yeah.
Wasn't there like a training facility that could turn gravity up and down?
Yeah. So Goku's spaceship on his way to Namek actually does that as well.
So that's actually legit. So
okay.
you could do that. So again, going back to continuous thrust. So let's say you have, when they were doing, for instance, when the astronauts are going to the moon, they would turn on this big giant rocket, the big engine on the back of the rocket. And they'd be kind of thrown back in their seats at about roughly, I think it was 1G. So if they were crazy and got out of their seats, they could have just walked on the back wall of their vehicle as if they were on the surface of the Earth. And so if you are flying to a planet and you can keep your engine on, that whole time, you can kind of dial in whatever acceleration you want. You turn your engine off, you're going to coast and you're going to have 0G. You turn your engine on, you know, superpower, you can have 10G, 100G, whatever, if assuming you've got enough propellant and your vehicle is up for it. So that's one of the things that seems completely legit to me, at least.
Okay. And they do have it in the spaceship, but they also have it on Earth.
That's not legit.
Okay. Because at Capsule Corporation, they set it up for Vegeta.
I guess you could have a big centrifuge. You'd have to be really big, though, because otherwise what's going to happen is if you wanted to, like, experience, like, higher gravity on Earth in a centrifuge, if it's not really large radius, what will happen is you end up in a situation where,
how large?
It depends on how high you want to go.
Vegeta goes up to like 500 or something.
That's going
to
be really big, because what will happen is you can end up in a situation where your feet are at 500G, but your head is at like 450. And that can cause, for one thing, Vegeta will be puking a lot because it's going to be really disorienting. But also, it would probably mess with your movement. If you're training in there or whatever, that's not going to be great.
Okay, so this kind of gets back to the fact that we later learn that the planet Vegeta, the Saiyan homeworld, is naturally 10 times gravity of what Earth is. So that's why they kind of train for that. Because Goku gets to Kaio's planet and it's a heavier gravity. And they're like, oh, well, this is what the Saiyan homeworld is. So you should get used to it. And then, you know, you'll be on equal footing for when you fight them on Earth.
I think it would actually be harder for them to then land on Earth. Because imagine it'd be like trying to fight on the moon. Only worse.
Oh, you feel like you're just flopping all over the place.
Yeah, like you're all your...
Well, there are established fighters that have been to many different worlds. So
maybe they get used to it that way. Because like, I think about stuff like when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, they had to kind of literally learn how to move. In fact, if you look at the Apollo 11 footage, it looks kind of funny. You'll see kind of Buzz Aldrin kind of go skipping past the camera a couple times. Yeah. And it's goofy to look at, he's literally learning how to walk. And what they all kind of independently settled on was like this kind of like bunny skip, like kind of bub up. But also they had to learn stuff like, hey, your mass doesn't change just because your gravity does. Mm-hmm. So you can't turn fast anymore. Mm. So for instance, you know, maybe these fighters who are used to 10G, they might be counting on, it's almost like Arrow, third time we'll bring up today, in F1, is that like, you know, when they're going through those corners, they're using the wings to basically increase gravity, to push them into the ground harder so they can get that traction. So like, if you're used to 10G, you might go to like turn real fast and just slip and fall over because nothing's pressing you into the ground anymore. So I think that could actually be a real disadvantage now that I'm thinking about it, unless you specifically trained in a wide range of gravity levels. So I got to think about that one.
Okay. What else haven't we talked about that seems like it would be relevant to this? I mean, it's kind of like a very focused point in the series. We have these aliens that come to Earth, then we leave and go to another planet. And then for the most part, we're back on Earth the entire time. There's some stuff later in Super where they go back to the same planet again. But there are a couple other planets here and there that aliens are from. There's a wide breadth of aliens.
Yeah, so one thing I will say is that for a long time, no one was really sure how common planets were. And, you know, it was a big thing of like, you know, is this just kind of it? Which I think is crazy. There were people who legitimately thought like, oh, well, this is it. These are all the planets. It's like, we can see like, you know, trillions and quadrillions of miles away, and you think this is it. But now we know for sure, because there are different missions like the Kepler Observatory that will use a variety of techniques to look for planets around other stars. Yeah. And one technique they use is if you watch the light of the star very, very closely, as a planet passes between you and it, it will dim just a little bit.
Yes.
And it will happen on a regular pattern in a regular way such that you can start to figure that out. So, you know, now we know there's thousands and thousands and thousands of planets out there. And they're even getting to the point where they can start to figure out, like, you know, where in the orbit they are. They can kind of directly image some of them by using, there's a special instrument. I keep wanting to say coronagraph, and that's not it. Basically, you can block out the light of the star physically, which allows you to then take like long exposure of anything around it. And you can maybe see planets that way directly. So, you know, the idea of like them discovering, you know, once they can get around faster, that, hey, there's all these other planets, all these other species out there. You know, maybe they're probably further away than would be convenient for a story. But like,
yeah,
totally. Also, I want to know, do the hardworking engineers at Capsule Corporation, do they go immediately descend on these Saiyan vehicles and start tearing them apart to learn about them?
So we do actually get that more in filler in the TV series. But yeah, after Vegeta and Nappa, like, they land and then they leave to go fight, we get all these folks in basically in spacesuits, like, coming up to it with instruments to try and, like, check it out and see.
We still got Nappa's vehicle, right?
Yeah.
So yeah,
they're just sitting there.
Yeah. Well, because Vegeta, he left in his own, right? He got back in. It's been a while.
Yeah. So they both land. Then Vegeta and Nappa land in their ships. They get out. Nappa blows up the city. Vegeta's like, what the fuck? There might have been a Dragon Ball here. What are you doing? Like, oh, sorry. And then they fly away because they have their scouters. So they see where the other characters are.
Sure.
So they leave their spaceships and fly there. So in the meantime, the news and the media and the scientists all descend on these two pods in the middle of this fucking crater here to see what it is. And then when Vegeta loses, Gohan fucking crushes him as the giant ape. Vegeta pulls out his little device and he, like, bloop, bloop, bloop. And his space pod, like, comes flying over and picks him up. So Nappa is still there. And then there is a funny later scene where they're trying to figure out what to do with it. And they're watching it on the news. And I forget what buttons, who presses it, but they inadvertently blow up Nappa's pod.
Oh no.
Yeah.
So they don't get to learn anything.
Yeah.
But that's smart. I was just thinking they would need to have some sort of self-destruct mechanism in there because you don't want whatever, you know, backwater planet you're landing on, learning how to do it and coming back at you. And also, I was just thinking, so Vegeta gets on a system and calls his ship back.
Yes.
That implies a lot.
So it's got GPS to his device or to him or,
it's got GPS, you
like
say.
Relational GPS somehow.
And all right, this implies, for one thing, he doesn't have direct line of sight.
Right,
so they must have deployed some sort of communication satellite in Earth orbit. And unless they were assuming they'd be there for a really short amount of time, they'd have to have at least three positioned like 120 degrees around it to build this big triangle around it at geostationary orbit. So basically they had to build their own little Tedris network. But then even that wouldn't get you GPS. So I wonder, I guess Vegeta could have, maybe he could be putting out a signal that the ship, it just goes up and then homes in on it and basically crashes into it.
And that's basically what it seems to do. Yeah. We didn't talk about this, but Vegeta makes a fake moon so he can turn into a great ape.
Just like a balloon.
It's like a light thing that he makes and puts up in the sky. I don't know what the question
is. Why is it just like pointing in his own eye or something? Why is it got to go up in the sky? So these are my questions, Mike.
Because it reflects a certain amount of Brutes waves from the moon.
Okay.
All right. Never mind. Let's come back to your questions.
Wait, no, I want to know where that's going.
No, that's it. And they're measured in Zeno. It's got its own.
Is that like the frequency of the light?
Maybe.
It's the polarization. You get the polarization wrong, people turn into big giant monkeys.
No, it's just science because they have the tails. It puts off a reaction. I'm not going to pull up this language, but they absorb it. And then because they have the tails, because when they don't have the tails, they can't transform anymore.
Where does the mass come from? They're sucking it in. Here's the thing. If they were in space, in the vacuum of space, would they still transform into the big monkey?
So in Dragon Ball GT, they're on new planet Tsufuru, and the full Earth results in them transforming into a great golden great ape.
Full Earth? I thought they were on another planet.
Because they look back at Earth and then the Earth is...
But they're on another planet, so it's like, even if you're like at Venus...
No, but it was like next to the moon. They can see Earth.
Did they bring this planet here?
They created an all new planet.
Okay.
You want to watch GT?
I don't know.
A lot of good space stuff in GT.
I got to think about that one. That's confusing. So if they were in... Because if they're in a vacuum, they could get bigger, but they could only keep the same mass, so they'd be like a monkey balloon. With all the mass distributed around the edges.
It's just kind of like filled with air. So
yeah, or filled
them.
With nothing. Oh, so you can't pop them. Oh, no.
Oh. We do know that their armor can stretch with them.
Yeah, I want to know, like I was asking you before, I want to know about the material science behind their armor.
Yeah.
I guess that kind of goes back to they beat up nerds who build the good stuff for them.
So we actually know that at some point, oh, God. All right, let me pull this up. Here we go. So the kind of best we get of this, you can picture what Vegeta and the other characters wear in terms of what their armor's got, like shoulder pads and stuff.
Yeah, some have the pads, some don't. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So at some point we get when they're on Namek and he's like coordinating with the Earthlings, they get smaller versions of these battle jackets. And he says that these are made for the planet. The people of planet Rito, which are smaller and end up being bird people that we see. So they've got different sizes of these, but at the same time, they can stretch. So do they need different sizes? I don't know.
Maybe there's like a certain base level. Maybe if it loses power, it goes back to the default level and it uses power to expand or contract.
Sure.
I'm trying to think. Is it like non-Newtonian fluid where like the harder you hit it, the harder it resists it? Or I guess you see it break sometimes.
It can be cracked. So yeah, Yajirobe like slices the back of Vegeta there.
See, I feel like if we piece together all these, we need a material science expert on here.
Yeah, yeah.
To start piecing together the clues.
Materials.
Could you use it as a heat shield?
I don't know.
Just imagine someone like hiding behind this little thing of armor and just like as they come smashing back in their spacesuit. You don't even need the pod anymore. That's a good point too. Why don't they? There's a good point, me. Why don't they? Why do they need to? Why don't they just like get out and fly and land? Why do they come crashing down? They could be like Yuri Gagarin. Yuri Gagarin. So this is Yuri Gagarin, first human in space. Went up in Vostok 1, flew around the planet once, and after reentry, he gets out and parachutes down according to plan. So my big sticking point is he did not complete a full space flight. Alan Shepard landed with his vehicle. He should get the credit. But anyway, why doesn't Vegeta and Nappa do that? They can fly. Maybe they just like crashing into the ground.
Maybe. They like the destruction. Yeah.
That wakes them up. Could they have blown up one of the Dragon Balls by blowing up a city? Was that just their ignorance or is that a real hazard?
Yes and no.
That's a long no.
There's stuff about can they be destroyed and... Because one of the earliest things we get is Yajirobe is actually wearing one of the Dragon Balls as a necklace, I think it is. So he was able to pierce it.
He doesn't like put like a suction cup on it.
No, but they appear to otherwise be indestructible.
Maybe Yajirobe is just like way stronger than we give him credit for.
He, like Mr. Satan, he's actually an incredibly strong earthling. He's just not like these other.
Yeah, I'll do it for the fourth time. It's like when you look at like, you know, like whoever's like, you know, last play, you know, look at like Guan Yu Zhou. Like, you know, like this guy stinks, but he's like still an F1 driver.
The
Yajirobe is, you know, the back marker of the Z fighters.
I don't know what else I have. Let's look around the room. To your right, there's actually a space pod on that shelf. I don't know if that gives you any more ideas. That's an alarm clock.
So I don't see a propulsion system on this. So I don't know.
You can open it too. You can kind of see inside. There's a clock inside. So it's
there,
not would, really...
there is a lot of volume. So they could put a lot of systems back there. Maybe it like opens up a little door because they don't need to. Maybe they're coasting most of the time. So again, that kind of gives you clues about like they're not using continuous thrust at that point because otherwise you would see the like whatever thruster you got there. Also, it's not a perfect sphere. This is like a different spherical section for the window, that could actually make a pretty big difference in reentry. Although I guess maybe they're kind of going in back first, like normal NASA crew missions.
I guess so. You think when they land, like in front is the hatch that opens up.
Yeah,
so.
But you kind of. There's a long way down from space. So, like, for instance, they could be maybe in one attitude for reentry. And then by the time they get through all the heating effects and everything, they're still like in the stratosphere. You know, they're still, quite a bit up there. And then they could transition to like whatever mode, crashing attitude.
We do have one alien later in the series, I guess, in addition to Frieza. His name is Jiren. He looks like a generic gray alien. At least in the super manga, he just fucking flies from one planet to another just on his own. That doesn't seem super possible.
So again, I will say one thing I don't think we touched on before when talking about this is you can briefly, like even humans can be briefly exposed to a vacuum, kind of longer than you might expect. If assuming that it was this kind of a, maybe not everyone's seen this, but the one thing I think of is there's a scene in Event Horizon where a guy basically has to like, you know, knows he's going to be out in space for like a minute and you can kind of prepare for it. And that's actually like, you know, there's a lot of nonsense in that movie, but that's kind of legit. Like it's going to mess you up. It's going to hurt your lungs. It's going to, you know, you're going to pass out and all your capillaries will start bleeding and everything. But like, it's not like in the movies where you just kind of like blow up.
I was going to say, can you just like hold your breath and fly to another planet?
If you find yourself in a situation where you're going to be in a pure vacuum, do the opposite. You want to breathe as much air out as possible, and you want to like not hold it in. All the air is going to rush out of your lungs one way or the other, and you want it do it without resistance. Otherwise, it's going to tear you up on the way out, and that's going to be real, real bad.
Okay, so don't hold your breath.
No, because
hold your breath after getting rid of your breath.
Well, there'll be none left. So, this is my practical advice. If you're going to be in a vacuum.
I'm going to take some notes here.
Don't hold.
If in vacuum.
Don't hold your breath. Ideally, you see if you could like, you want to kind of compress every part of your body if you can. So like in a real pinch, you can maybe wrap yourself in duct tape very, very tightly. That's not going to be great for very long, but like it's something. So maybe that's why he's gray. He's just using duct tape. Frieza hides it. He paints it.
I don't think any of that's true.
No one's seen Frieza under the duct tape. That's my assertion. You got a wiki? I'm going to go edit your wiki.
You got a source for that?
Yeah. Me. Just trust me.
All right. Trust me, bro.
Wait, I got one more.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there the usual, like, did human spaceflight history play out the same way alongside all this? Like, for instance, are there astronauts in the Dragon Ball universe already before we get these other space aliens showing up?
So there are basically two competing science organizations, really, Red Ribbon and Caps Corporation.
Okay.
Caps Corporation seems to be it. I guess the best I can give you is in Dr. Slump, like, they do see the moon and, like, they have astronauts there.
Okay.
So there's someone doing something somewhere. So also in Dragon Ball, it's worth noting that there's a single king of Earth. So it's...
That's going to make things way easier, though. You could just say, like, all right, we're space program. Make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes it cut through all the bureaucracy.
Right. I don't know if that helps.
So to your knowledge, it sounds like maybe in Dr. Slump, there might be something like the Apollo program, but there's no, like, space shuttle that you're aware of in the Dragon Ball universe.
I don't think so.
Should be. What about Raditz? Did he have a vehicle? Did he take that back? I forget how that ended. They killed him.
Gohan burst out of it in anger.
Ah, oh, so he ruined. They're always ruining these.
Gohan was crying, so Raditz threw him in there. Oh, and then yeah. Raditz was beating up Goku, and Gohan's like, don't hurt my dad, and he bursts out of it.
Maybe they can analyze the pieces.
Well, then the way that Goku gets, and maybe this is a whole other question, the way that Goku gets to Namek is he has Dr. Brief use his original ship that he came in as a baby.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
But then they make it bigger.
That's tough. It's going to be tough. They could just shove him in there.
Yeah, yeah.
So they got a baby-sized ones, too.
Yes. They have infiltration babies that they send to other planets.
I would imagine it'd be more practical to infiltrate with not babies.
Well, the whole deal is, like, most of these other planets are either uninhabited. And then the weird thing we get in Super is that apparently there are only 28 planets with, like, worthwhile, intelligent life on them, which really seems to contradict some of the stuff that we saw previously. But
I was gonna say,
so be it. But
I'm thinking through, like, all the different looks all the different aliens have. And how many of those can you count up?
Well, maybe he's collected them all and he destroyed their planets, because that does seem to be what's 28 happened.
28 left.
Yes, exactly. As we get some, especially I'm thinking of DBZ movie 3 in particular, we have another sign who's been out there and he's collected some other folks, but they're like, you know, they were sent to destroy this planet. And this one guy was like, he tried to rebel and Tullus was like, I don't know, you seem pretty cool. I'm joining my gang. He's like, all right. And then they still fucking destroyed the planet. So yeah, we went from 29 to 28. So,
all right. This one isn't related to space at all, but it just occurred to me. Just thinking, like, you destroy the planet, it's kind of equated with destroying the species. But there are obviously at least a couple of Saiyans out there. Were there any Saiyan women out there too? Could it be possible to bring the species back? Or is it just like Goku and Vegeta?
Well, they keep changing this. But, and depending on whether you're talking about movies or like real continuity. So as far as we knew, at some point there was Raditz, Goku, which Goku was like, oh shit, we forgot that we sent him off to a planet. So they thought it was really just Raditz, Nappa, and Vegeta.
Yeah.
Then later, depending on what you're reading, we get Vegeta's younger brother, Tarble.
I've never heard that name.
So he was so bad at fighting, he just got fucking sent off. Like, forget this dude, just get rid of him. So he's out there, and he married another little gray alien. But then, depending on the movies, so we have Paragus and Broly. We have this guy, this is Tullus that I was talking about.
Because, like I said, there was some character, when I made that AMV, the Bardock AMV is like, well,
so that was before Frieza destroyed the planet. So yes, there were signs on that planet.
So, and they all came blew them all up. Blew them up.
Yeah, yeah. So the whole deal was Vegeta was off planet on a mission with Nappa and Raditz when it got destroyed.
Because that's interesting too. So from that we can kind of suss out, like, well, it's not like there are thousands of missions at the same time. Either that or he recalled them all first.
Well, that is exactly what it is. He called them all back to the planet. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But because Vegeta was the prince, so he was like...
He's busy.
Yeah, yeah. Leave him out there. But maybe that gets into the question of why can Saiyans and Earthlings mate?
Yeah. There's like some other, like, you know, progenitor species before them.
Right.
And then one grew tail and got all strong and one were just like wimps.
Yeah.
We got the wimp genes. But we made the Apollo program.
Sure.
That's pretty cool.
I love this. This is great.
I'm trying to think of anything else. Yeah, it would be really kind of cool to take a really close look and try to extrapolate out systems that we know must exist just from simple things of like, hey, Vegeta called a ship to him. It's like, okay, that implies so much.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to think of other stuff like that. But yeah, I think the other thing that people maybe underestimate is when you're talking about like how far away are these planets? So far away. It's like, you know, the distances in space, even for close, quote unquote, close things, it's crazy. It's so far, even stuff within our own solar system. You know, for instance, they're kicking around an idea right now of making, who knows if this gets accepted, but people are trying to make a proposal to send an orbiter to Neptune, you know, well within our own solar system, kind of the edge of the solar system. Yeah. This thing, if they built it, if they launched it, it wouldn't get there till like the 2040s. You know, you're talking about designing a mission that, you know, won't even launch for, you know, 15 something years, and then it's going to take 10 or 15 years to get there. And that's here. Whereas, like, you know, if you're going out to other star systems, you know, they must have some really sick technology to be able to make that remotely possible. You're looking up numbers.
So I just want to give you a Dr. Slump example. This relates to both the moon and Venus. I'm just going to read from something that I had written before. Chapter 136 of Dr. Slump, Arale, Gachan, and Sudodin, they use the time slipper. They go back in time. They arrive. They find cavemen and various animals running around in fear. There's a giant meteorite approaching the planet. Gachan, who's a little angel thing, stops a meteorite, and Arale headbutts it because now she can do this. She sends it flying into the moon. And this is what I was talking about later. Later on, astronauts find an impact crater alongside hand and footprints on the moon. They adapt it in the TV series to be Venus. So there's like this imprint mark of Gachan on Venus from when they pushed it, this meteorite back.
That's going to be tough on Venus. There's a lot of really harsh environment. I'll put it this way. Only a couple of human probes have ever landed on Venus, and within minutes, or I think an hour at the most, they basically melt and break.
Got it. Well, hey, hold on. All right. So this is going to be the last thing we talk about before we get out of here.
All right.
This is great. I could go forever. So while we're on the topic of Venus, so Toriyama did this one shot called Kintoki, and a character from Kintoki makes a cameo appearance in a title page for Jocko the Galactic Patrolman. Jocko is, spoilers, a Dragon Ball prequel. So that means Kintoki takes place in the Dragon Ball universe.
Okay.
So in Kintoki, there's a character named Merluza. She lies about being a Venusian.
Okay.
She says she doesn't even turn the fan on until the temperature reaches 1,000 degrees. So I did the research on this. In Japanese, it's 1,000 degrees Celsius. So at least we at least get that. And then I found the surface temperature on the real life of Venus reaches 880 degrees, 471 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. So 1,000 Celsius would be pretty hot.
Yeah.
That'd be like, oh, yeah.
She's lying. She's just,
I don't even turn the fan on until it's 200 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah. I just think that's funny. Like, we got all these numbers being thrown out there, and I am from this planet.
I like it.
Yeah.
We should send more stuff to Venus. Venus is cool.
All right.
America hasn't sent anything to Venus since 1989.
Let's what are we on. Doing?
Need more money. Everyone vote for people who want to give money to NASA.
Okay. JP, thank you. This might be my favorite podcast episode.
I'm always up for talking about space, and it's really fun to tie it in to something that is not only fiction, but something where space accuracy is reasonably an afterthought. I'm like, okay, well, let's see if we can like tie this all together.
Yeah, anyway. So it's not that Toriyama doesn't try.
Yeah. So it just sounds like he's tried more than I really expected, to be honest. So,
yeah.
You know, props to him.
That's cool. Why don't you talk about your podcast a minute here?
Yeah. So like I said, The Space Above Us, it covers, so far I've done everything before the space shuttle. So if you're interested in the space race and the Apollo stuff, that's all there. Done almost like, you know, most of the shuttle program at this point. Did the shuttle mirror program, which was a super fun delight to discover. Like, you know, I had no idea how interesting that would be. That was when American astronauts were living on the Russian space station. And right now I'm working on the episode for the first long duration crew on the ISS. So we're getting into the ISS construction era, getting kind of close to being done. Although I've been kind of slowing down the release schedule a little, you know, it's just been kind of happening.
You know what that's like.
Yeah. So I had to update the website. It used to say it comes out every other Thursday. Now I'd say ish. If you want to learn about real life spaceflight, you want to get really into the weeds of like not just saying, hey, they landed on the moon. Be like, no, what did they do? What switches did they hit? Why? And, you know, how do they train for that? How do they know that's the right thing to do? That's the kind of stuff I get into. So come on by and we'll, you know, learn all sorts of fun space stuff.
Where do they look for that?
Go to thespaceabove.us or, you know, put The Space Above Us into whatever podcast player you're using. Hopefully not Spotify, but I guess whatever. If you're going to listen, use RSS readers, people. Thespaceabove.us.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a good time.
Gosh, there is just so much going on right now, isn't there? So what can I tell you about the site? Well, over on Konsenshu, every week with a new Daima episode, Friday nights and Saturdays are a busy time for Heath and myself here. The episode guide continues. Every episode of Daima gets a new entry in the episode guide. Yes, we have a summary of the episode, but check out all the notes. Check out all the credits. Heath is actually getting too fast with the credits. It's like by the time I get around to even starting anything, he texts me and says he's done with the credits. It's actually a little frustrating, Heath. Slow down a little bit, please. I will say it's the best place on the internet to get all that information all in one convenient package on a single page from folks you can trust. Other things going on the site. I know I teased this last time on the show, but it wasn't quite live when the episode went up. It has since been added live, and that is the new rumor guide entry. Is the Turtle Hermit a Tenkaichi Budokai champion? That's live on the site. Check it out. Some stuff you may remember, some stuff you may not remember, all adding up to a somewhat interesting answer there. I know we've talked about manga stuff a lot lately on the podcast as we head into November here, where Super Dragon Ball Heroes is coming to a close. Dragon Ball Heroes, after what, or 13 years, that series is ending, and Dragon Ball Super Divers is taking its place as the card-based arcade game in Japan. And with that, I know we talked about this last time, but Toyotaro contributed a single chapter, just simply titled Dragon Ball Super Divers, so not very easy way to catalog that, over in V-Jump last issue. Since we last talked, the next issue of Psycho Jump, the December 2024 issue, hit. And in there, we had a couple interesting things. We had the return of Dragon Ball SD to serialization. Naho Oishi came back with not quite a serialized story, but a single one-off chapter celebrating Dragon Ball's 40th anniversary. By the time you hear this podcast, I'm committing to having that news post up on the site. The thing that's taken me a while is I summarized that fun chapter, but then also what started in the same issue was Yuji Kasai's new Dragon Ball Super Divers promotional manga. It's really frustrating to translate because it's Retsu! Exclamation point. Supa Daibu! Exclamation point! Exclamation point! I hate it when they put exclamation points like in the middle of a sentence. So we're just going with "Let's Super Dive" as a title on that one. And the thing that's frustrating is it's such just a nothing, boring, dumb little comic that I've been putting off doing a summary of the chapter for its news post, and I can bind it all into one Psycho Jump thing. But hey. Dragon Ball SD, speaking of that, yes, actual returning to serialization. Oishi's coming back to the pages of Psycho Jump, it sounds like, starting next issue in the January 2025 issue, which will be at about a month from now at the very beginning of December. I don't know offhand if it's going to pick up where the YouTube version is leaving off, or if they're going to go back to where it left off in print and has been serialized in video form after that point. Guess that remains to be seen. We'll find out next month. So that's the happenings there. Other things to leave you with. Stay tuned. We have a guest podcast spot theoretically recording as I release this episode tomorrow. So be on the lookout for that. Should be a great conversation. Extremely appreciative to have been invited to that. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. Just a lot of appreciation. What I do in these times is I kind of focus on facts and truth and reality. And I do that in different ways, and how that manifests in my fandom is kind of doubling down on the work. It's important to me. And because of that, a lot of folks have approached us lately for help requests, and I can't thank you enough. I don't know how much has been announced, so I'll just say name redacted. Thank you for the book draft and allowing me to take a look there. I'm excited to see what's going to come out of that. Had a researcher over in France reach out with some incredible questions, working on a paper there, something to be published in the next year or so. Just having folks find us and then realize, oh shit, like, they do actually know what they're talking about and can provide a wealth of information and cited resources for this. The fact that they find us is incredible. And then I get so much out of, I really do, just answering questions and providing and dumping my brain out for them. So thank you to all who have asked us for various things. I've seen some other stuff come in on social media and Reddit and other places. Just a lot of good comments lately, unsolicited. And I really don't know where I'm going with this, but just thanks. That means a lot. Hearing from folks. Yeah, I really thank you. Thanks so much, y'all. That said, www.kanzenshuu.com. That is kanzenshuu.com, as I look at on the homepage of our site, documenting Dragon Ball since 1998. Got you covered. Yeah, we're coming up on another year rolling over. We hit that 2025 January, and that's going to be year number 27 for me at this game. Couldn't ask for much more. I appreciate y'all. We will see you again next time. I don't know what the topic actually is next podcast. I gotta consult the schedule and see what we got coming up. So stay tuned. We'll see you next time on the podcast. My name has been Mike Vegito EX. Thank you much, folks. See you then.